This is the Medic Cast, November 1st, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medic Cast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I will be talking a lot about where you can find additional information this week. We've been covering some of the American Heart Association Emergency Cardiovascular Care 2010 guideline updates that have just recently come out. And I had the segment about a week or so ago with Tom Boothelet and Dr. Monica Kleinman from the American Heart Association, a special episode that showed up on a Monday. So if you are looking in your iTunes feed and it hasn't showed up, go over and check out that article. It's coming on Monday, October 18th, 2010. You can find that over at the medicast.com/blog site. You can also, if you have the regular iTunes feed, it'll show up there. Just go ahead and look in your recent art episodes. If you don't have it selected in your iTunes to download all podcast episodes, it will miss episodes periodically if it's off schedule sometimes. So you can just find that there, click the Get button, and it'll download it for free. So anyway, when I finished that interview with Dr. Monica Kleinman, we went ahead and brought Tom Boothelet and I kept talking for about 40, 45 minutes, talking about what some of the guidelines meant specifically to the EMS sector and some of the things that we were looking forward to seeing more about as far as training, some of the updated video training that might be coming along, some of the additional things we didn't cover in the interview segment with Dr. Kleinman. So I thought it would be great to put that into this week's episode segment. And it's an audio-only recording, but I'm going to go ahead and put together some PowerPoints with some of the questions and basic answers and some links and information on where you can find other things in the video portion. So if you're watching this episode, you can go ahead and look forward to that. There'll be some good information coming across the screen, even though it was basically an audio interview between me and Tom. But you can follow up on that information if you want over at medicast.com/blog. If you like what you heard or you have a comment or a suggestion or maybe a correction on something we were talking about, love to hear from you, and I can always forward any questions to Tom if it's not for me specifically. You can shoot those emails in to me at podmedic@mac.com. I love to hear from each and every one of you. I try to return every email I get, so if you have sent me an email and I haven't gotten back to you and it's been a couple of days, shoot me another email. Sometimes things get lost in my inbox and I apologize. Don't think that I'm avoiding you. I'm pretty busy and I'd love to hear from you. So send me another email. You won't bother me. I will try to get back to you, even if it's just with a short message, and let you know that I got your email. So anyway, I will be getting into that segment here with Tom here in just a second. I do want to remind you, you can find the MedicCast Facebook fan page over at Facebook.com/MedicCast. And I would urge you, if you're on Facebook, to become a fan of the MedicCast. We're, at that point now where we've really got quite a few fans over there, some great discussions and responses to things that I post only on the MedicCast fan page. So I might put questions over there, some short video segments, special links, or other things that come up to me according throughout the course of the week. And sometimes it's just easier to post things there because I'm on the go using my phone and my mobile device. So it's just an easier way to get information out, and if you're a fan, you'll get it right on your Facebook page, and you'll be able to follow up on that. And again, that's facebook.com/medicast. Just click the like button at the top of the page, and you'll become a fan of the MedicCast. You can also, of course, personally find me over at Facebook on facebook.com/podmedic, and over at Twitter as well, twitter.com/podmedic. I look forward to hearing from each and every one of you. Of course, there's also the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. So we'll be getting into that interview with Tom Boothelet from the Pre-Hospital 12 Lead blog and our follow-up discussion after we had talked with Dr. Monica Kleinman from the American Heart Association about the 2010 ECC guideline updates.
To me, this is an awesome that the American Heart Association is ready, willing, and able to reach out to pre-hospital professionals at such a high level.
Really, I was struck by a couple of things in these guideline updates, and I mentioned them in my questions. And I expected and knew that you would go deeper, which is why I wanted to make sure you were included in the call. But you know, I try to take that that. I'm a community CPR educator. I live in a rural area. I know you're in a similar situation. You know, you bystander CPR is so important. So I so focus on those basic BLS things, even though I'm a paramedic and treating people at that level as well. But you know, if there's no CPR going on before we get there, there's not a whole lot we can do if somebody's been down for a period of time. And I noticed that for the first time, they have a recommendation for terminating resuscitative efforts for adults. They basically implemented a series of recommendations on when it's acceptable for EMS professionals at the BLS and ALS level to request permission to call the code.
Right. And well, and I'm glad they did. I think it was actually in JAMA over the past year, the CARES registry, or at least data derived from the CARES registry, proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that there were circumstances within which a patient's odds of survival approached zero. And especially, I think, today in emergency departments across America, some of them are extremely busy, and cardiac arrest patients that have a virtual prognosis of zero tie up a tremendous amount of resources. And so there's often no magic wand inside the emergency department, and heck, it's questionable as to whether or not the drugs we carry on the ambulance do anything for our cardiac arrest patients anyway. So the idea that somehow after 20 minutes of ALS care that we're going to transport these patients to the hospital and then something magical is going to happen, you know, in the trauma bay in bed one that's going to make them walk out of the hospital, it's borderline delusional. So it's nice to see some evidence being brought into this process to sort of put pre-hospital providers at ease and let them know they're not straying off the reservation or playing God. They're just implementing a protocol that is evidence-based and shows that you know, life is finite, and often, and the largest killer in the industrialized world is cardiovascular disease and sudden cardiac arrest. And we know that the prognosis is extremely poor at the time of collapse for virtually all cardiac arrest patients. I know, Dr. Eisenberg in Seattle would vehemently disagree with that. And I think we do have to have the mentality that a witnessed VF arrest can be saved. But the reality, there's a stark reality out there as well that basically says a huge number are unwitnessed, and a huge number have an arrest rhythm other than ventricular fibrillation. And if we work them for 20 minutes and there's no return of spontaneous circulation, and now with tools like the end-tidal CO2, if their CO2 is below 10, we know these patients aren't coming back. And I have not read, and I don't remember the exact recommendations for the 2010 guidelines, but I think it's high time that we did what we had to do in the living room, and if the prognosis approaches zero, to not put the public at risk by running lights and sirens to the emergency department.
Well, I have them right here in front of me, and I'll read them, the resuscitation guidelines. It comes under the section of ethical issues in the 32-page whatever release document that I received or found when I was looking at the updated guidelines. And it specifically talks about EMS terminating resuscitative efforts in adults. For BLS termination of resuscitation, the guidelines that their recommendation are unwitnessed arrest, and that's unwitnessed by EMS responder or first responder. No return of circulation after three complete rounds of CPR and AED, and no AED shocks delivered. So that was for BLS professionals. So, yeah, that's why I was struck by it, because it's right. You know, it's pretty basic.
Well, sure. I mean, the truth of the matter is, if you're looking back over your career, how many cardiac arrest patients that were unwitnessed did you have that walked out of the hospital?
Not too darn many.
Right.
So they actually implemented a separate ALS level, which is pretty similar, but there's a few things that they've added. The one thing primarily they added was no return of circulation after complete ALS care in the field. Everything else is the same. You know, unwitnessed.
Sure.
But it's for ALS, it's unwitnessed by anyone. No bystander CPR, no return to circulation after ALS care, no shocks delivered.
Right. So, well, that makes sense to me for the unwitnessed patient.
But, pretty basic guidelines. But I'm happy to see that they've implemented that, because I think one of the things Dr. Kleinman said in her interview at the very end there, when I asked about what she just wanted to leave us with, and it was just very basic, but it was what you're doing in the field as an EMS professional makes a difference in a cardiac arrest patient. And so often, and I wonder if you run into this problem as well, when you're educating your BLS providers, when you're doing that CPR recertification, because of the abysmal rates of patient survival, there's a feeling like, why am I busting my back doing this? Because it seems like it's not making a difference. And I think implementing a reasonable protocol to say we can call it in the field, instead of just making us continue to pump and work on that chest for 20, 30, 45 minutes, get the patient to the hospital and you walk in the door and the doctor calls it. which is what happens in my system all the time. Because they know they don't want to tie up their ER resources for something that they know is an untenable arrest.
I remember when I first became a paramedic in 1995, and Jamie, I don't know how long you've been a paramedic, but the dogma back then was that paramedics weren't licensed and had no authority to declare death in the field. I think there was like a very injuries incompatible with life, or maybe if the head was cut off or something like that. But for the cardiac arrest patient, we had to bring them to the hospital so that the doctor could say, okay, this patient's dead. And, I think the other part of it is paramedics and EMTs and paramedics maybe don't have much education or training in how to deal with family members after a loved one has died. And so rather than deal with a grieving family or have to explain why the tracheal tube's being left in place for the coroner and helping them deal with their grief or maybe contact the funeral home and things like that, it's easier, isn't it, sometimes just to load the patient for transport and bam, you're out of there. And the aftermath is left to somebody else. And so I think going forward, it's good that we have these algorithms and it's good that they're evidence-based. And it's good that it's more safe for the community. We're not careening down the street with lights and sirens for a patient that has a profoundly poor prognosis.
And actually, it's interesting because they actually cite that in the rules under their "Why are we implementing this change?" They say implementing these rules reduces the rate of unnecessary hospital transport by 40% to 60%, decreasing associated road hazards, placing the provider and the public at risk, inadvertent exposure of personnel to biohazards, and the higher cost of ED pronouncement, which that last one really caught my eye, because certainly in this day and age of healthcare reform and looking at cost-based healthcare, it is clearly a higher cost to go into that hospital setting where they have to at least hook the patient up to everything, and now the family's got another bill for a patient that didn't need to have any care at that point.
Sure. And hopefully if the 2010 guidelines, which are very much a validation of the 2005 guidelines, are aggressively implemented by communities. I think we're finding this out, or have found this out, on Hilton Head Island, is EMS is not... should not be in a silo. So someone has to take responsibility for each community's chain of survival. And I would suggest if it's not the EMS system that takes responsibility for it, then who will? So I think it's important that we get all the stakeholders around the table. We had a hypothermia meeting at Hilton Head Hospital a week ago, and it was nice and I think unprecedented to look around the table and see representation from EMS and from nursing and from emergency medicine and from cardiology and all the stakeholders in care that are sort of looking at the process all the way from living room floor to walking out of the hospital, all around the same table, discussing the same thing and working toward the same goal. So I think developing that kind of synergy and getting all the stakeholders together is really the importance of that, I don't think, can be overemphasized. So whether it is collecting high quality data by reporting to a registry like the Cardiac Arrest Registry to enhance survival, so you know your numbers, but also looking at the entire system of care, because none of us can do it alone. And so this new link in the chain of survival, this post-cardiac arrest care, so that when we come in with a patient that has achieved return of spontaneous circulation but is in this persistent comatose state, the first thought of the emergency physicians isn't, well, oh, geez, okay, they're still unconscious. They probably have a poor prognosis. Okay, the ECG shows acute STEMI. Do we even bother sending this patient to the cath lab? They're probably going to die. Can transition into, okay, we have a patient with ROSC. They're persistently comatose. Let's get this patient to the cath lab and let's get them cooled. And so, the thing we used to say with patients that we found in a hypothermic arrest is, well, they're not dead until they're warm and dead. Well, I think until they're cooled and then rewarmed and dead, it's sort of like the same thing. Maybe those patients lived because they were cooled by nature. And maybe we have an opportunity now to cool some of these patients and then reworm them. And I think we're going to learn a lot more by the 2015 guidelines. One of the things that fascinated me was when Dr. Kleinman said, we don't know. We don't know the exact number of minutes. And of course, there's a certain point at which I think she called it, a point of no return?
Yep.
But I don't think it's clear anymore what that time is. And maybe as more EMS systems report their data and more patients become cooled, that we can start and kind of zero in on what that number is.
And I think you're right. I mean, it's all about the research and keeping the data and monitoring that. And I really liked the focus on communities monitoring themselves and really tracking the data. And do you think that that's something that smaller systems can do effectively when they don't they don't necessarily have all the resources that major hospital systems or larger EMS systems have to have a dedicated person to capture that data? But certainly the focus here is on data capture and monitoring and looking at your own individual resuscitation rates.
Well, I agree with Dr. Brian McNally, who is the principal investigator for the CARES Registry, that we would never accept tenfold differences in operative mortality inside the hospital. And hospitals have no choice. They have to report their outcomes. And so I think EMS, it seems like with so many of the different podcasts and so many of the different blogs and the entire EMS 2.0 movement, what we have seen or continue to see is a call for EMS to grow up as a profession and take its rightful place along the other legitimate healthcare professions. And that can't happen until we take responsibility for our designated area of medicine, which is the out-of-hospital environment. And so I think it's, I don't really, this is my personal opinion, I don't think it's excusable for an EMS system to say, well, gee, we'd have to hire somebody to collect this data. It's like, well, hey, you know what? Too bad. You know, if you want to have an ambulance and you want to go out and run calls, and one of the key reasons for your existence is to save patients that are having life-threatening problems, and we know the importance of tracking this data so that you can achieve improvements with your chain of survival. If you're not willing to invest the time and effort to do that, I think it's time to take a good long look in the mirror and ask yourself, why are you here and what is your purpose?
One of the things that you and I've talked about in the past and you brought up briefly with Dr. Kleinman was just the uptake rates of these new guidelines. I mean, we still have systems, major systems out there that are still implementing things recommended in the 2005 guidelines. How do we come forward as a group if we still have people that are almost in the last century in their cardiac care?
You know, that is the question, isn't it? The recent discussion that we had on the EMS research podcast looked at this very issue, and we looked at two different studies. One of them was from the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium, and the other was from the Netherlands. And both of them looked at how long it took for the 2005 guidelines to be implemented. Both of them, the average time to implementation was like at least a year, year and a half. And what I found most notable about that is these were EMS systems that tracked. These were the ones that looked at their data. These are the ones that even knew. So it seems to me if the ones involved in research, like the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium, if it takes them a long time to implement the guidelines, then just imagine how long it takes an EMS system that has never been involved in data collection, has never been involved in research, and has no idea how many patients experience out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in their jurisdiction, how many have return of spontaneous circulation, how many are admitted to the ICU, and how many walk out of the hospital. I think the odds are for these types of systems, it probably takes longer. And in fact, one of the paradoxical findings of the study is they kind of just assumed, well, it would be easier for a small EMS system to implement the 2005 guidelines on the simple basis that they have fewer paramedics to train. But they found out the opposite. It was the larger urban EMS systems that had far greater numbers of paramedics that were much faster at implementing the guidelines. And basically, it alludes to the same thing that you said, because they have dedicated people. They have a dedicated training officer. In some cases, they have a full-time medical director. And maybe they have a training center.
And I want to stop here because I know you just said something, and I know that people are going to misunderstand that statement. You don't mean that they're not dedicated to the job. You mean dedicated people, as in people that whose job it is to provide that education, to get that update out there to their community in larger systems. They have the resources to have that person whose job it is to implement.
Absolutely. And thanks for that clarification, because I would have been horrified if anyone would have interpreted my statement that way. No, I'm not talking about their emotional dedication at all. I mean that is their job, is to deliver this training, so that they have a person whose career is dedicated to their full-time job is teaching or educating or maintaining the certification and competence of their EMS personnel.
So along those lines, I have a thing here talking specifically about implementation and education and some of the key issues that they identified in the new guidelines. Two years is too long an interval, according to the new guidelines, for skills, practice, and reassessment. And they are recommending that skills performance should be assessed regularly during the two-year certification process, with additional reinforcement provided as needed.
What I liked is the 2010 guidelines emphasis on sort of a distinction between the sequence model and what they call the choreographed model. So what I would suggest is, if it's important for us to be swapping rescuers that are doing the chest compressions every 2 minutes, and if it's important for us to perform chest compressions prior or while the defibrillator is being prepared, but not necessarily for 1.5 to 3 minutes of chest compressions. But if it's important that at least some chest compressions are delivered prior to the first shock and things like that, we ought to decide, each EMS system needs to decide what their choreographed model is going to look like. And once they've made that determination, train on it, videotape it, and develop this, what I'll call the pit crew concept. This isn't, I'm not the one that originated this terminology, but I know it's happening in various locations throughout the country that are doing very, very well, and say, okay, what is this EMS system's pit crew concept? What are the positions? Is there a chest compression position, and someone is at the airway, and someone else is doing the shocking and IV start and the drugs? Is that position 1, 2, and 3? I don't know. Each EMS system is configured differently in many locations. Fire department first response arrives first in the vast majority of circumstances, and then the EMS or the ALS ambulance arrives after. They may or may not be part of the same organization, but they are part of the same EMS system. So I think it's important that they look at that they intelligently approach the cardiac arrest patient, that they share similar protocols, that they train together and that they implement best practices. And once they know what those things are and they evaluate those processes, then I think they can train on their own better than any type of class taught by someone that has no clue how their EMS system is configured. So,
and I want to be clear, because I don't want to give the wrong impression. I don't think the guideline says that they should be recertified at a closer interval, because it does not say that, and they're not recommending, hey, we want you to buy more cards from us. What they are recommending is that in between that 2-year interval when your card is renewed, that continuous practice and reassessment of your skill level is necessary. And I think you and I would both agree that that's very important, and probably many systems are already doing that. But I think that in places without that, and I don't want to say dedicated, seems to be the word we want to use, but without that designated training officer who is going to make sure that people are up to date and the skills are being practiced regularly, that those systems need to find a way, and those EMS professionals on their own have a duty to find a way to make sure their skills are sharp all the time.
Well, I agree with that, but I also think, you know, if you speak to people that have gone through the resuscitation camp, I can't remember what it's called in Seattle, the Resuscitation Academy, they QI 100%.
Yeah.
Of their cardiac arrest calls, and to the point where they even listen to audio of the calls themselves. And so I guess to me, if you are a professional rescuer out on the street and it is your job to save people or to minimize their suffering that have experienced a sudden cardiac arrest, then this is something that we should approach with the idea that we need to be performing at the mastery level, at the expert level. And so however many times it takes you before you feel that you can implement these protocols at the mastery level, then that's how many times you should practice doing it. And so because none of us in an EMS system practice in isolation, no one person can do it all in a cardiac arrest setting, that indicates the need for teamwork. And teamwork is not accidental either. So, you know, teams that train together and practice exactly the way they want to play, I think we'll be able to develop that synergy to where there's no chaos on the scene, and then things become second nature and it's taken to a high level. So,
and it comes back to that choreographed model. It's not just a sequence of things that have to be done. It really is choreography. It is a team approach where, you know, just like in a football game, you know, the linemen have to move together in a certain way on each play. To some go behind the other guy, some, you know, they all have the way that they have to move in a choreographed manner to accomplish the task. And we're no different. And it's interesting. At EMS Expo, I had the pleasure to sit down and interview Troy Smith from King County EMS, and he talked about the ways that they are examining, like you said, 100% QI and QA of cardiac arrest calls, and they're looking at audio of the calls, and they're looking at but he was very clear to state that something as simple as reducing by 1 second the time lapse between when you get back on to the chest to begin compressions again had an outcome change. And you don't, you know, you think, okay, a couple of sec, what's the difference of a couple of seconds? But really it comes down to, and he said, this is something we've become so good at in our and I can insert choreography. He didn't use the word choreography, but I can insert choreography because I think that's what he meant. Something as simple as just getting the team to work that much tighter together so that change was of 1 second had a positive outcome for the patient. You know, that's practice, not watching a training video, not doing certification training, but practicing as a team so that choreography flows in a manner that we reduce interruptions, we reduce times where we stop and go, who's next?
Well, sure. And you know, it's interesting. I had first heard this from Dr. Lurie, the inventor of the rescue pod, but I've subsequently also read it in some writings of Dr. Wesley. And that is, you know, there may not be any single silver bullet for cardiac arrest patients. What we're looking at is the implementation of a constellation of best practices. So, you know, we need the early recognition. We need the bystander CPR. We need EMS to be performing best practices in the field. And those are things like minimizing the interruptions to chest compressions, maybe delivering asynchronous ventilations at once every 6 to 8 seconds. You know, one thing that I love about the Wake County EMS model is it's very standardized and it's very repeatable. Now, granted, they also send an advanced practice paramedic, so they end up having a very experienced paramedic on every call. But even without an advanced practice paramedic, if they, a witnessed cardiac arrest patient with an initial rhythm of V-fib and an uncomplicated airway, so no vomitus and no blood in the mouth, they can implement chest compressions, capture the airway with a King, apply a rescue pod with quantitative waveform capnography on top of that, continue the chest compressions, squeeze the bag when the light blinks, and the waveform capnography will let them know when they have return of spontaneous circulation. So if you're doing that, you're going straight to easy IO, especially when the patient has poor peripheral access, and you're minimizing the delay between stopping compressions and shocking. You're doing all these things, and then when you have ROSC and the patient is persistently comatose, you implement the ice saline and you start the pre-hospital cooling of the patient, which is continued inside the hospital, which after a while actually gets experience doing it because it's very scary for them in the very beginning. They're not ready. They're not used to the shivering. They're not used to the bradycardia. But I think once that system gets rolling and everyone understands their position and their role, that is when they start developing these miraculous numbers of people that are walking out of the hospital. And that's its own reward. I think once everyone starts seeing, wow, look at all these patients that are showing up at our survivor ceremony, it is its own reward and it's its own validation. And it makes you realize, you know what, this is really, really important.
And I think you brought an important point in there, Tom, is the importance. You know, we talked about the choreography, but the choreography is not just among the EMS providers on the scene. That choreography extends to our relationship with our local emergency departments, our medical direction, and coming up with a system whereby we are implementing procedures in the field that can be continued in the ER. So there's not this disconnect where we do everything that the EMS is going to do, and then we go take them to the ER where the ER does the next step. Anything we can do to kind of blur that line and let things carry over in both directions, I think, is part of that choreography.
Well, sure. And I think the most powerful example of that is the concept of parallel processing with pre-hospital activation of the cardiac cath lab for patients experiencing acute STEMI, and then maybe bypassing the closest non-PCI hospital and taking the patient directly to the hospital capable of prompt, expertly performed primary PCI. We're seeing the dividends that this is paying in regions like Southern California or the state of Minnesota, or more recently, South Carolina, which is developing an entire statewide STEMI system. And so you're absolutely right. If EMS does its thing, and then the ER does its thing, then the cath lab does its thing in three separate segments, you're never going to see these 38-minute door to balloon times, or even these like 60 minutes 911 call to balloon time. To do that requires a high level of coordination and mutual respect between EMS, the emergency department, and the cath lab. So I think it's the same model that needs to take place with hypothermia, meaning that we do our best practices. It starts with public education, of course, and the bystander CPR and public access defibrillation programs, but then EMS performing its own best practices. And then when they achieve return of spontaneous circulation, are they capturing a 12-lead ECG? If it's showing STEMI, are you letting the hospital know that you have a patient with ROSC whose ECG is showing STEMI who needs to be cooled, or that you've implemented cooling on? So it's very complex, and many EMS systems, I think, some of them have their doubts about whether or not they want to invest this many resources in a percentage of their call volume that is maybe 1% or less. But then again, that's why I would challenge them and ask, well, what is your reason for being? Is it to transport a patient to the hospital and then send Medicare a bill? Or is it to be a pillar in your community and help restore these victims of sudden cardiac arrest to their families with their pre-arrest neurological status? I mean, to me, that's a vocation and that's a calling. And that's the most important consideration. So I think we need to give it, I think we need to concentrate on this problem with all our minds, with all our energy, with all our innovation, and really give it our best shot, regardless of what our current financial situation is. Because within the context of whatever you have now, it can be optimized. And those lines of communication can be opened between yourselves and your medical directors, and your medical directors in the emergency department, and the emergency department in critical care, or the cardiac cath lab, or even on a regional basis between PCI hospitals and non-PCI hospitals, or, as Dr. Kleiman alluded to, maybe eventually cardiac arrest receiving centers that have the resources and the expertise to implement this therapeutic hypothermia.
One last thing, and then we'll go, because I know we both have things to do, and I want to make sure we get this interview out today and posted. So, and I'll make sure you get a copy, the link to that, and a copy of the file so you can use it as you see fit. But one thing that I was really excited to see in the guidelines comes back to that very first part of the chain of survival, bystander CPR, bystander AED use, and their new recommendation. Use of an AED does not require training.
So. Well, absolutely. You know, heck, if doing PCR does not require previous training, then there is absolutely no reason whatsoever that a dispatcher should not be able to talk someone through the use of an AED. And so I wonder how many dispatchers are there in the United States or perhaps throughout the world that are ready to have, you know, do they have a book that is device specific? So if someone says, yes, I have an AED, okay, well, what is the name on it?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I don't even think they're even talking about dispatcher training. They're talking about that an AED, if you see an AED hanging on the wall, you can grab it and put it on the patient and use it safely and effectively without any prior training. Which for me in my, you know, and I'm in a rural area. I want to see more AEDs out there. I want to see every church in my community with an AED. I want to see the supermarket with an AED on the wall. You know, I think AEDs should be included in public building codes the same way that sprinklers are included in public building codes. And this is just another step for me in that direction. Do you think that, you know, I think that I could hand somebody an AED and give them a mannequin and say, you open that up and tell me if you can do what it's, you know, if you can apply this.
Well, I guess that's going to be highly individual, because I know oftentimes what you might be able to do in the relatively low pressure setting of a training environment with a plastic mannequin, when you have that acute stress reaction or that flight, that fight or flight syndrome happening during an actual real life emergency, it is really hard to learn something new when your brain reverts to that more primitive state. And so I think what makes more sense to me, I certainly have no quarrel with the idea that someone would attempt to use an AED that maybe had never used one before. It certainly isn't going to hurt anything. But I guess just my thought is two things. One, that dispatchers should be prepared if necessary to talk someone through it. And then two, and this is one of the things that we're looking at on Hilton Head Island right now, it is uniting the bystander that has called 911 with the nearest AED. You might know that there's an AED at the supermarket, okay, if you're the one that is coordinating the AEDs in your community, but will the bystander that witnesses the collapse know that there's an AED at the supermarket?
Amen.
So I think the dispatcher needs to know when they call up the address, oh, you're at the such and such supermarket, little lightning bolt appears on the corner of the CAD system. Oh, there's an AED. Go to the manager's desk and ask for the AED and then bring it back to the patient's side. Or even there's an AED at the Starbucks at the end of the parking lot. Send someone to go get it. So just the knowledge, or be able to call up a GIS map layer that shows, okay, here's the supermarket. Ah, aha, there's an AED symbol on this business right next door. someone needs to go retrieve the AED.
Or even call, because they know that the AED's there, call that business. Someone and come say, hey, get your AED. Have it at the door. They're coming.
Yeah.
If you see people and waiting maybe, in the parking lot, go to them.
And maybe it would be nice also if the EMS system would then replace the pads free of charge or something like that. So I think these are all opportunities that we all have. And frankly, I think we have opportunities through EMS 2.0 in our online communities and social networking, podcasting, like we all do, to sort of share these best practices and these ideas. We don't have to wait necessarily every 5 years to be spoon-fed everything. We can come up with some of the innovations ourselves if they are so obviously appropriate to what we're trying to accomplish.
And that choreography, again, we come back to that point of, I think we need to remember that choreography extends system-wide, and that is from the bystander CPR moment and implementation and practices for getting the AEDs in our community to the patient when they need them, all the way up through post-resuscitation care. And we need to include, really, it's a system-wide approach. We need to include all of the stakeholders, from local businesses, local community organizations, survivors, all the way up through our medical direction, public health system. We need to bring everybody into the system and include them in this discussion so that they can say, well, this will work for our community, or this won't work, but maybe we can do something different. And because every community is going to be different, and then we need to capture that data. It comes back to that. Because if we can show success with something we're doing in one system, it can be implemented somewhere else.
Well, sure. You know, it's been said so often, maybe we're a little desensitized to it. But on the other hand, it can't be said often enough. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So if we only pay attention to all our small link in the chain, and the chain's broken on either side of us, the end result will be the same, and that's a neurologically intact survivor not walking out of the hospital. And so I think the chain of survival in a community needs someone to step up and take stewardship and say, you know, we need to look at this from collapse to walking out of the hospital. And since no one person is responsible, it really has to be a very collaborative team approach between all the stakeholders, which means that someone needs to get that team together for a meeting. And you know what? You and I both know, Jamie, people exist in silos, whether in business or whether in medicine. And oftentimes, politics sort of bleeds in, and people have their little areas, whether it's EMS, whether it's nursing, emergency medicine, cardiology, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. Those walls need to come down, and consensus needs to be built, and everyone needs to go back to the basics and realize, guess what? This could be your mother. This could be your father. You know, Jamie, it was just this past Wednesday, my girlfriend's daughter, who is like a daughter to me since she was 4 years old, she's 14 now, experienced a near drowning at the rec center on Hilton Head Island. And she was found at the bottom of the pool, and she was taken out, and bystander CPR was initiated immediately by a physician whose child happened to be swimming at the pool. And 911 was contacted immediately, and the response time was excellent. And she was whisked into the emergency department, and she was successfully resuscitated. And she just walked out of the hospital the day before yesterday. So if that's not a powerful enough reason for people to get together and work together and make the chain of survival as strong as humanly possible, then I don't know what is.
Yeah, and boy, Tom, you know, I feel for you, but that is just an amazing story, and it brings it back home, because we're always caring for everybody else's families, but when we're at work, who's caring for our families? And that
That's
chain
right.
of survival better darn well be there for my kid.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, I'll tell you, anyone that's ever lived through anything like that, and I was on duty on the south end of the island, and when I heard the call go out, and then I called my girlfriend and to ask where her daughter was, and just then the call came on the other line, and we found out that it was her. And so I wouldn't wish that experience on anyone, but I will say that there is no legitimate excuse for anyone not to play well with others and exist in their own separate silo if it's going to interrupt this chain or weaken it. And so it has to be approached the right way. And unfortunately, the process can, in fact, be weakened or sabotaged by any group of people that are responsible for one of the chains that aren't fully doing their part to strengthen their area. But once all that resistance melts away and people start getting excited and getting on the same page and wanting to do the best thing for the patients, which is, my God, if you didn't get into this business, I don't care if you're a paramedic or an EMT or a nurse or a doctor, it doesn't matter what you are. Why did you get into medicine? Who amongst us, when we got into the medical field, got in it with the idea, well, I don't really want to save anybody, you know?
Yeah.
But the reality is we can't do it by ourselves. We need each other. And more importantly, our patients need us to need each other. And so that needs to be our guiding force. And that patient advocacy and that idea that it could be any one of us, it could be any one of our loved ones, needs to take center stage so that these conversations of, it's only 1% of our call volume, or, you know how much time and effort and money that would take to train everybody how to do this pit crew concept, or, you know, I just don't think we have any money to put refrigerators or freezers of any kind in our ambulances for hypothermia. You know what? Those are all excuses. And it indicates to me that you haven't seriously researched the issue, or you would find out there's ways around that kind of stuff that don't require a huge investment of money. So before we're dismissive about the process or decide that it can't be done, my question would be, have you tried? Have you tried? And so what I would like to see with the 2010 guidelines is I would like to see EMS systems across the country basically stand up and say, you know what, there's some exciting things happening. We've got some pockets in the United States right now that are showing some impressive numbers. Where are we today? Where do we need to be? And how are we going to get there?
And on that note, Tom, I just want to say it is always a pleasure to interact with you and talk with you and have you on my show. And I can't wait to hopefully see you again, hopefully coming up here in March at EMS Today. I hope we have a chance to sit down and talk again. And maybe we can revisit, all right, here we are 6 months later. How are things being implemented?
Right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, Jamie.
And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I hope you enjoyed that interview segment with Tom Boothelet from the Pre-Hospital 12-Lead blog. You can find a link to Tom's blog over at the MedicCast website. MedicCast.com/blog will take you over to the MedicCast blog page. You find a link for the show notes right at the top of the page. Go ahead and click that link, and you'll find the most recent episode listed first. Scroll down till you find the episode you're looking for. If that's this episode and it's this week, well, this will be the most recent episode. But you'll be able to find links to Tom's blog, links to more information on the ECC 2010 guidelines, and other information from different bloggers and places around the web that you might find some useful information about the updates. There'll be a lot more coming on this. I'm sure this discussion will continue for many, many months. And I'm looking forward, I'm hoping to catch up with Tom at EMS Today in Baltimore in March. And we'll probably have some more discussion on implementation of these guidelines and how that's moving forward and whether services are moving forward in the way we expect them to. So we'll be talking more about that. If you'd like to leave a comment for me, of course, you can leave a comment on any of the blog posts, and it's easy to do that. Just click the comments link and go ahead and fill in basic information, just your name and email address to make sure you're a real person. And then go ahead and leave a comment. Let me know what you think of the articles or the episodes over there. Of course, you can also send me an email, podmedic@mac.com, and you can always call in on the voicemail line as well, 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is your way to call in on the voicemail line. Love to hear from you that way as well. The MedicCast fan page is facebook.com/MedicCast. Click the like button to become a fan. And of course, twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic is a great way to catch up with me. That is it. We're going to wrap up the show with a song from Jeff Smith. And this is a song we've played here before called Not on the Radio. If you like what you hear, check out the music and links for Jeff's songs. There's even a link there to go ahead and purchase some of his songs over at the iTunes store. And just click that button, check out all of his songs, and maybe pick up one of them. If you like Not on the Radio, you can even pick up that one over there. So go ahead and support Jeff and the other PodSafe artists that share their songs with podcasts like the Medicast. That's it. I'll see you again soon. In the meantime, don't forget the very important thing to keep in mind whenever you're out on a call, whenever you're around the station, scene safety, BSI.
Somebody told me you're in San Francisco. They said you're working in a box,
yeah, a cubicle.
Somebody told me that you're not on top of the world. You're probably walking down the street with your earbuds jammed so deep in your ear,
yeah, you're going deaf.
You probably found this little MP3 for free. Way cooler out there,
yeah, I think so.
But maybe you just like it in your cozy little world. Well, you can play this, but not on the radio. I made this just so I can let it go. Does anyone around here still have a radio? Virginia, we can make it on our own,
and we're doing just fine.
I can't afford your record, but it's out of sight. Well, you can play.